Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, February 26, 2018. The time is 9 a.m. We're in Juneau, Alaska, where it is snowing for all those skiers that have been waiting to take to the slopes. It looks like there's going to be plenty of snow. This is the Senate Finance Committee. We're in the state capitol on the fifth floor in Senate Finance. I'm co-chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, co-chairman Hoffman.
Good morning.
Vice chairman Bishop.
Good morning.
Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Machicki, Senator Stevens, and Senator Olson. On today's agenda is HB 195, Ensures Use of Credit History and Scores. To my knowledge, we've received no amendments. Second on the agenda today is HB 120, Department of Law Advocacy before FERC. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, if you would direct your attention to HB 195. Last week, we heard the bill on Wednesday, 221. We took public testimony. We covered the fiscal notes. And as I said before, we've received no amendments. If I could invite Lori Wingheyer, the director of the Division of Insurance, to the microphone. Welcome to Senate Finance. Lori, if you could identify yourself for the record and please provide the public and the committee your thoughts on House Bill 195.
Thank you. This is Lori Wingheyer, and I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. HB 195 amends credit scoring, which is currently allowed in the state of Alaska on new business for personal lines. This would be auto, homeowners. It does not impact life insurance, health insurance, or commercial lines. What this bill does is allows credit scoring to be used on the renewal business as well as new business. It also provides that the insurer provide the consumer, the customer, with written notice of when credit scoring is used and if an adverse action has been found that's going to be detrimental to the consumer. When that is done, the insurer must then tell the consumer that they have a right of an appeal. The appeal goes for extraordinary life circumstances, which are spelled out in the bill. The consumer would appeal to the insurance company first if they did not think their credit score was correct and had a material impact on their premium. The second appeal would come to the Division of Insurance for adjudication. And that, in essence, is what HB 195 does.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wingheyer, if this is such an important bill or not such an important amendment to the bill, why was it not included the first time when the bill was when the credit score bill came through?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, when the bill first came through as in 16, there was an appeal process, but it allowed the insurance company to be the final adjudicator of the appeals. It did not allow extraordinary circumstances to include the provision of what a prudent person would be. And the governor did not feel that those consumer protections were broad enough, and he vetoed the bill and reintroduced it himself in 2017 with the broader protections. I don't know why the drafters did not spell it out more clear or put the broader protections in 2016. It was an industry bill. It was not the administration's bill at that time.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Ms. Wingheyer, during the public testimony on February 21st, 2018, we did have a question that was brought to the committee about the definition of a new applicant. And we want to make sure that that all applicants can use their credit score to help reduce their premium. Is that accurate?
Madam Chairman, the Division of Insurance will not mandate that insurance company use credit scoring. But if they elect to use it, then they will use it on new business and renewal. But such as GEICO right now does not use credit scoring at all. If they decide to, if this bill becomes law, then they would use it on new and renewal business.
Thank you for that clarification. So all renewals, whether they're currently insured now, it's not going forward from the date that the bill passes, but any that have insurance that may renew should their companies use credit scores as part of the composite for determining their insurance rate, that they will be included in that also.
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last time we met, the issue was brought up about where's the proof and statistical information, and I thought we were going to receive something on that. I haven't received that. So could you clarify just again so we understand that a person who has poor credit rating may be more likely to have accidents?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stevens, and I apologize for not getting that back to you last week. The statistics from the NAIC and other organizations show a correlation to credit, period, and the actions an individual would take, such as maintaining their house, good health, maintaining their auto, their driving record, all sorts of things that one would look at when that come up in a credit score. And that credit score then becomes a part of what they consider the insurance score. And they just show a correlation between good credit, that if one manages their credit properly, then they most likely manage the rest of their life properly as far as maintenance, obeying laws, home inspections are taken care of. There's just a correlation that no one can really understand, but it most definitely is there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens, which raises the issue of no credit. Could you just state on the record again, because we do have, for those that didn't testify, we do have documents in our file, written testimony from folks who have contacted Senate Finance to weigh in on this issue, and those documents are posted online. But we do have some that are rightly concerned about families that have no credit. So could you speak to no credit being used in an adversarial way to determine insurance premiums?
Madam Chair, if a consumer has no credit because they've paid for everything at cash, regardless of what age they are, or they're just young, and this is the first time they've applied for insurance, they will not be penalized for not having credit. However, they may not be put into a preferred program because they don't have credit. But they will not be penalized. So it's a zero-sum game for them. They're not getting a better premium, but they're not going to get a worse premium. They're not going to be penalized for not having established credit.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
I'm having a hard time drawing the distinction between being penalized and putting into a higher bracket. Isn't that a form of penalty by somebody that doesn't have a credit score, by being asked to pay more than a counterpart that may be just as credit worthy?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's if we can't determine, or if the insurers can't determine the credit score, then there is most likely that they will be paying a higher rate. They won't be in a preferred program if there isn't a credit score, but they will not be put in a lower tier program either.
Just one comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I feel like I'm having a disadvantage here, maybe correlating with the credit score, because with all due respect, this is the second time I've been confused with the Senator from Bethel.
Thank you, Senator Olson. With all respect to everyone, as I understand it, this bill passed with overwhelming support, something very similar in the last legislative cycle, and the governor vetoed that particular proposal and has brought us back a new proposal for consideration along the same lines. Any further questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly to recap the fiscal note, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, appropriation is insurance operations, OMB component numbers 354. We did cover this last week in great detail. The bill modifies the existing statute and is not anticipated to have a fiscal impact on the Division of Insurance.
We have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 195, version 30-GHI-926/A. From committee with accompanying zero fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Senator Bishop, I'm looking closely because I had one number letter off on I, and I believe you may have said it this time too. Moving from committee 30GH1926/A from committee.
Backslash A, yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Good morning. Welcome back to Senate Finance. The next item before the committee is House Bill 120. It's an act relating to the Department of Law public advocacy function to participate in matters that come before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, sometimes known as FERC. Senators, I'd like to direct your attention to our audience and welcome TCLL program from Harbor Elementary School. Welcome to Senate Finance today, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate you joining us and watching public policy in progress. I'd like to invite John Batasson, Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy Department of Law, to the microphone. John, if you would put your name on the record and then please provide opening comments. It is only one section, so we'll forego a formal sectional analysis. If you could tell us what this one paragraph allows Department of Law to do.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair. My name is John Patasson. I'm the Chief of the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy Section at Department of Law. Obviously here to discuss HB 120, a bill that would allow the Department of Law to recover costs related to cases that we get involved in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We have a slide deck that Ed Sniffen put together last year. I'll go through this quickly, and please feel free to stop and ask any questions along the way. So first of all, the first question is, what is the regulatory cost charge? Well, this is it's essentially a fee that's assessed on public utilities and pipelines that are regulated by the RCA. It's been a function of statute for quite some time. And if you ever look at your own utility bills, not your phone bill, but your water or your electric or your heating bill, you'll see that there's this RCC charge. And it's, you know, if a family of four, it'd probably be about 4 cents on the bill. But so that is essentially what funds both the RCA and the department that I, or the section that I oversee, which is RAPA. Again, who pays RCCs? It's 125 public utilities and about 20 common carrier pipelines with in-state deliveries. That's both oil and natural gas. And again, they pass the charges along on to customers, as I described. It's a line item on most people's bills.
Madam Chair, do you know what the annual revenues are from these fees?
The annual revenues, we can get to that a little bit later, but
okay. If you're getting later, thanks.
Okay, thanks. And then again, the next slide deck kind of explains what the RCC pays for. There's an independent commission, the RCA, that basically determines whether rates are just and reasonable. And part of these RCC charges go to that office, which is a five commission board with its own staff that looks into utility rates. And then a smaller section of the RCC, 0.17%, goes to the Regulatory Affairs Public Advocacy section, and that's what I oversee at Department of Law. And again, our mission is to make sure that utility rates are just and reasonable, not only for the utilities, but also for oil and gas pipelines.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Just going back to the previous slide.
Sure.
Are there any utilities right now in Alaska that are not RCC regulated at this point? Are not regulated?
Through the chair. Senator Von Inhofe, yes, utilities can actually petition the RCA and have a vote to essentially say we don't want to be regulated at this point. I can think of a few larger ones. I think Nome Joint Utility System is one that just has decided for whatever reason not to be regulated.
Senator Von Inhofe.
So then when they're not regulated, are there financials available to the public at all?
Because I don't regulate those entities, I don't know how that would actually work. We've never been a part of a case where, local individuals were trying to discern the financials of a investor-owned utility in an area that's not regulated by the RCA.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff, multiple utilities are not regulated and have, if the process described previously is accurate, there are multiple utilities in smaller populations in Alaska that are not regulated. And we do have an issue there statewide because there are different costs. There are different costs associated with administering those utilities, as well as a different level of age of all the infrastructure. And so the costs are huge. And I speak to that from this past interim working on trying to reduce energy costs for some of these smaller communities and ran afoul basically with that we couldn't extract the information from where we wanted, and the smaller utilities have fixed costs, and those fixed costs are spread on a very small population. And how it related in the research was we were trying to look at energy efficiency in state buildings, which are sometimes the anchor tenants for these smaller utilities. So as we invest in energy efficiency, it looked like we were going to see cost savings when in fact we did not, because the fixed costs and the administrative costs to run those utilities had to be spread over the same customer base. So the state wound up paying pretty much the same amount of money because we were the anchor tenants in some of these smaller utilities. So,
well,
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I guess just my questions were leading towards the recent bill that we heard to extend the bonding authority for the Fairbanks Interior Gas Project. There was, in fact, a hearing after the purchase of the Fairbanks Natural Gas Company with the Pentex purchase for $54 million. And after reading the transcript, it was actually a pretty contentious hearing in terms of the valuation of Fairbanks Natural Gas, and that was an unregulated utility. And it has since forth been regulated because of the arguably by some inflated purchase of the FNG, which of course has been trickled down to the Interior Gas Utility now as the prices are set for Fairbanks consumers. So I do bring that up because it does matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Mr. Patasson, please continue.
Sure. So when we talk about the RCC, the question is ultimately, you know, how do we actually fund this? Where does the money actually come from? And basically what it is we've got the adjusted gross revenues of all the utilities that are regulated, both pipelines and your other utilities. And so under rate regulation, essentially the companies are entitled to collect money from the public, from consumers. And so what we do is we take that amount of adjusted revenue that they actually make by virtue of being monopoly utilities and pipeline carriers, and we essentially take 0.87% of that revenue that they collect, and we allocate it between both the RCA and my section. So the RCA, the commission essentially gets the larger bulk of it, 0.7%, and the RCC funds my section to the amount of 0.17%.
If we could go back to that slide.
Sure.
I'm trying to clarify what you just said. The RCC is funding the RCA at 0.70, and the RAPA and the Department of Law cannot exceed the 0.17, correct?
That's right.
And then can you tell me, is that – you see, you in your second bullet point, you say statute allocates 0.87. So it's very explicit in state statute for that rate?
That's correct, yes.
And then is it as explicit as how the funding is separated, or is that in regulation?
That's also by statute.
So. The 0.17 and the 0.70.
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the 0.87 pays for all the expenses of the RCA, for the commissioners, for the staff, for the space they're in. Is that true? It covers everything?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct. The 0.70 pays for the RCA, all of their activities. So.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Please continue.
So this is an illustration of fiscal year 2017, and this is kind of leading us up to our discussion about what the bill, HB 120, would do. In 2017, the fiscal year, we obtained, my section, $2.374 million from the statutory cap. And as you can see, that money is made up of both utility revenues that we were allowed to pull from and also the pipeline revenues. And as you can see, we were a little bit below in fiscal year 2017. So what would HB 120 change? And this is where we kind of get into the heart of the matter here. The bill doesn't change that 0.17 RCC cap that's in statute, nor are we asking for that. The bill will basically allow the department, when it's trying to generate revenues, when it's trying to basically do its formula to obtain revenues, rather, when we do work on cases in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, we can apply that to the 0.17% of the pipeline's adjusted revenues. So basically what this does is it allows the Department of Law to essentially, instead of using general fund monies to advocate in FERC matters, at least to a certain extent, we can recover that from the pipelines through the RCC charge.
We do have questions. Senator Bishop.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your scenario that you just outlined here, and I'm going to, you've got caps, TAPS pipeline tariffs as an example.
Right.
Right, you're not, this bill doesn't allow you any more funding. The 0.7 stays in place.
Right.
So you had a, you were under by 40,000 the year before?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, yeah. So to go argue in front of FERC and to be reimbursed, you would be coming from your existing budget.
Through the chair, correct. So for that deficit that we didn't collect from the RCC, that would, I believe in fiscal year 2017, that came out of general funds. So if we, in fiscal year 2017, had the ability to bill up to the cap for that pipeline work, we, as a section, I believe we would have recovered more from the RCC.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Please continue.
Thank you. And so the other big question is, how would HB 120 impact consumers? Because, you know, essentially it's the cost of the RCC, as I mentioned earlier, gets passed along to individuals who pay the pipeline rates or the utility rates. So pipelines, just like the garden variety utilities, would pass this along to their in-state shipments. So a shipment of a barrel of oil or a shipment of MCF of natural gas along one of the natural gas pipelines, the bill would allow for the utility, the pipeline carrier, to essentially charge their customers a little bit more to basically make up for this, what we're trying to do. It's actually not all that significant from our analysis. Adding 100,000 to the pipeline RCC would increase the surcharge in the RCC, very little money. And I think what's important is that the surcharge, the RCC, helps us ensure that the actual rates that are being charged by the utilities and pipeline carriers are just and reasonable. So it's essentially we're paying to ensure that the rates that are being charged are just and reasonable. So why are we doing this now? For over 30 years, the state of Alaska has retained outside counsel to represent the state in FERC pipeline matters. And given the financial climate over the last 4 or 5 years, to reduce costs, the Department of Law has been developing internal expertise in bringing more of this work in-house. And for the last 3 years, I've been working on the FERC matters, and when we talk about working the cases in-house, it's been a substantial benefit to the state. We have accountants and economists who work in the RAPA section who were not utilized in handling the cases before FERC. We used outside experts and outside counsel, and I'm very happy and very proud of the work that we've done in the last 3 years to basically bring this work in-house and to do a lot of the heavy lifting at both Department of Law and then utilize some commercial analysts, both at DNR and DOR, to help us understand these cases. So we're trying to basically make up for this increase in workload as well, because RAPA took on this extra work. We don't have new staff that we hired specifically to do this. We're doing this on top of also the utility and other work that our daily work. We're very happy to do it, and we're very happy to be a part of the FERC cases at this point. Again, just to take a look at the...
Mr. Potassin, can you hold for a moment? Senator
sure.
Hoffman, which slide would you like?
Number 10. So you say that for 30 years we've been using outside counsel. So how much were we spending in that regard? And then you say that by bringing it in-house, you'd reduce those costs. What are the numbers in reductions? And so we get some idea of what we're talking about here.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't have those specific figures, but I can, having been the section chief for a few years now, I can give you some anecdotes. I mean, as you may or may not know, we've been involved in TAP's tariff litigation for the 2009 to 2015 years, and to litigate those cases for just the 2009 to 2010 cases, the state spent $16 million. Our competitors spent $55 million. But in my view, having brought some of this work internal to the Department of Law, I don't a similar case probably wouldn't cost that much at this point. In the year 2016, as a result of the TAP's tariff litigation, we were in front of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Typically, we would have hired outside counsel to argue that case and to draft the briefing. And, I mean, we all know that outside counsel is expensive. I don't know what we would have paid, but I can tell you that in lieu of that, we did the work in-house for, I believe, under $25,000. So, I mean, we're talking about real savings here, and we're talking about, you know, functionally getting the same work done that we did before. And we also still retain outside counsel on these cases. We've just scaled back considerably how much we relied on them in the past.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Please continue. Senator Machicki.
Sure.
Just we have very limited FERC exposure in the state of Alaska, other than TAPS. Do you, what other FERC-related jurisdiction do you see where it would be your department's role to intervene? I mean, it's certainly not. I don't know if there are hydro cases, but obviously AKLNG is the next big one. But we have a separate state body for that. So.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Machicki. We not only FERC doesn't just look at the TAPS pipeline. There's a series of feeder pipelines, obviously, that kind of feed into TAPS, Point Thompson, for example, Alpine, Kaparik. So all these other pipelines, provided that they're shipping oil on an interstate basis, those companies not only have to have an intrastate rate applied by the RCA, but they also have to have an interstate rate. And there are occasions where the state of Alaska finds itself before the FERC ensuring that those rates are just and reasonable. That's one example I can think of. So it's not just TAPS. There's a number of other cases we may be involved in. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki, follow-up, then by Senator Bishop.
Is any of this related to AKLNG? I can ask that differently, I suppose. I was lumping the tap system sort of into one segment. But is that, does AKLNG have anything to do with it, which is obviously a major FERC process?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I'm not aware of any work that we would be doing on the AKLNG project as part of this funding. So.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going off a recall memory, so if I'm off base, just don't be bashful and tell me so. But you could, FERC also, you could have some crossover into hydro projects?
Through the chair, that's correct. For instance, when the Susitna-Wantana Dam issue was a large issue, I mean, there were FERC processes for permitting and all that. This wouldn't have anything to do with that. I suppose it's possible at some point with hydroelectric that there could be some FERC rate issues, but actually setting the rate for an intrastate basis, that would all be at the RCA because none of that power, I believe, would be leaving the state. So I'm not sure what the jurisdiction of FERC would be once the dam or some large hydro project would be built.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shocking to hear the $55 million figure that our competitors have spent $55 million against us in court. I think you said $60 million we had spent. Is it your opinion then that should we do this, it would not unfairly disadvantage the state? We'd still be able to go for outside counsel when we needed it.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct. We would still retain outside counsel for these matters. It's just a necessity. We have very good counsel. We've had them for 30 years. It's just we've decided to try to do as much of this as possible in-house and get some in-house expertise. So, but no, we would not be at a disadvantage if we were to allow for this funding. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, is there any impending need to go before FERC right now? Are there issues that are outstanding or high priority, or is this something that's sort of like a blanket need that we would pass this bill theoretically that you would use at some point in the future but not necessarily between now and the end of session?
Through the chair, there is no impending necessity for it. However, we're very busy in front of FERC as well. We have entered into an agreement with TAPS, for example, to I won't get into the details here, but we have a variable tariff methodology that every year my section has to basically work hand to glove with the oil companies to determine the just and reasonable rate in front of TAPS. So every year we're in a position where we may be protesting the TAPS tariff rate. Moreover, there are other pipelines that have business before FERC. I believe next year we'll have an issue with Point Thompson Export Pipeline to connect that line and make sure that that rate is correct. So there's always enough work to bill against in front of the FERC. So.
Mr. Patas, I'll follow up with a little more direct. On slide 7, as far as the Finance Committee goes, is this really showing us that there's open to buy, that we're collecting money that is going unspent, and you're opening up a recovery mechanism for collection, or is something else going on there? We're collecting more money than we're spending right now based on your statutory cap?
The answer is no, there's nothing like that happening. Basically, all that's happening is to the extent that we can't bill the FERC work to the 0.17, we're essentially paying for that in general funding. I hope that answers your question.
Well, I think you just said yes to what you told me.
Sorry.
But so for clarity, you have the ability to collect through a 0.17 statutory cap $2,374,390. And your budget is $2,000,000 $333,700, which on your slide represents $40,690 under the cap. So you could collect, or you could charge more because you can collect more. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, yes.
And so you're trying to, when I say open to buy, I'm thinking of a credit card, a retailer from way back. So what you're asking us to do is to be able to charge additional resources to this funding stream.
That's correct, yes.
Does that make sense, team? It won't change your how you're progressing from the administration's perspective, if anything, before FERC. You're just trying to get the approval to be able to charge some of your work towards this receipt fee.
That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Michiki.
Can we get in a little more detail on the increase in the pipeline cost, potentially?
What slide, Senator Michiki?
I'm sorry, slide 8.
Thank you.
Doesn't change the cap, but I'm not sure I completely understand all of this bill might section.
Again, to get into the weeds a little bit, so under current state law, there's basically two areas that we go after that 0.17 in the RCC charges. One side is all utilities, and then because pipeline carriers are kind of separated out, we also try to get the RCC funding from the pipeline carriers. So the pipeline carriers are kind of off to the side. So will it increase the amount of RCC allocated to the pipelines? Basically, what this will ensure is that of the adjusted gross revenues that are attributed to the pipeline carriers, we can apply RCC in the event that we do FERC cases that involve those pipelines. That's essentially all that means. Will it increase the amount? It's a difficult question because you'd have to forecast what we're going to do in a given year. But essentially, the cap is that, you know, for these pipelines, the most that we could ever charge is 0.17 of the adjusted revenues. So, and all we're doing is we're saying, if we can, you know, if that, let's say, you know, we could charge, let's just hypothetically say that 0.17 of the RCC cap is $100,000, and my section did $80,000 of RCA work and $20,000 of FERC work involving the pipelines. This bill would essentially allow us to collect that $20,000, whereas before we couldn't. It would have to go from general funding. I hope that answers your question. It's a bit complicated. Every year in June we get together and we run the numbers, but it changes every year. So,
if I might, so I pulled the state statute that the administration is suggesting to change 44-23-020E, and basically what we're doing in considering this bill would be considering the public interest in whether it's in the public's interest for the Department of Law to engage on behalf of the people of Alaska in this process. And if it is in the public interest, then the Department of Law is asking to recover fees. Specifically under E, it says there is established the Department of Law the function of public advocacy for regulatory affairs. The Attorney General shall participate as a party in a matter that comes before the RCA. And so it doesn't call out FERC as that recoverable expense, and then it refers us to 4205-141D, which is the powers and duties of the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act. And under 141D, the commission shall perform duties as assigned, and then it goes into those duties. So, again, that's how I got to the more simple thought process, that they're just really asking for rate recovery, and then it may or may not change what they're doing, but they can recover rates up to that $40,000 that was presented on the previous slide. But that money could increase based on throughput and utility charges, so that's not a That's not a fixed number, it's a fixed percent. So it can vary up if there's more money that is being, more volume that's happening inside of the utilities or through the pipeline, then that number could go up more and there would be more funds available to use for receipt money work versus general funds. So I think the bigger question from a policy side is it in the public interest for the department to advocate from a public policy perspective on behalf of the public on some of these issues? Senator Michicki, that's my interpretation of those statutes. I read it into the record so you could make your own thought process on that. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I specifically, and thank you for that information. It was valuable, but my specific question is, does the department have the ability to cost shift from the utilities to the pipeline carriers?
Through the chair, no, there wouldn't be any cost shift from the utilities over. I know this gets complicated, it arguably could go the other way. Basically, all we're asking for is that, you know, to the extent that we're doing pipeline work, that we be able to, under the state statute, collect for that work before FERC. There wouldn't be any cross-subsidization between, say, an electric company paying for my section's work in a pipeline case. That couldn't be a possibility.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
Just the last sentence is a bit confusing and sounds like, maybe you can just explain that for me, because that does sound like specifically an increase in the pipeline RCC would reduce the RCC paid by utilities. So that sounds like if you can bill for FERC work related to that, it would reduce the RCC paid by utilities, which would in fact be a cost shift, right? Or is that just sentence just sort of strangely written?
I think it's strangely written. I'll give it to you that. Basically, depending on a given year, if the state, for instance, let's say we're very light on utility and pipeline work, so we've got one cap that gets us to utilities and one cap that gets us to FERC. Or for pipelines. And let's say we're not going to hit either cap. So we'll stay below that. But that doesn't mean that the utilities are going to somehow cross-subsidize the work that my section does in pipelines. So we can bill up to the utility. We can bill up to the pipeline carrier cap. But they really never mesh unless we're doing, and this is where it gets complicated, a natural gas pipeline case. In those instances, it's been our view that because utilities rely so heavily on the natural gas pipelines, that we feel that could be subsidized by the utility side. So,
Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
No, I yield.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, through the chair, has there been a time where you have testified before FERC when you have a planning stage of a future pipeline? Because you talked about their feeder pipelines in Point Thompson, Alpine, and Kaparik, which you may testify in front of FERC for. What if there's a fourth feeder pipeline, let's just say, that's in the works, it's a future pipeline? Would you see your activities extending in that area?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, our section would not get involved until that pipeline company goes before FERC and says, this is the proposed rate that we intend to charge. We wouldn't do any of the permitting or any of the other things that may be before FERC. All my section essentially concerns itself with is the rates. So,
thank you.
Mr. Patasson, does the Department of Law right now have the authority to enter into conversations with FERC without the bill that's before us?
Conversations. When our section is before FERC, it's usually because of a protest. So we're not necessarily, it's essentially administrative litigation at that point. So we're... We're actually more in a litigation stance whenever we're before the agency.
Mr. Patasson, what I'm getting to is the language. It says the Attorney General shall participate as a party before FERC. That's what you're asking us to do. And even though you've shown us slides that show rate recovery, it is expanding your authority to engage with FERC. At least, let me just be direct. There is concern at this table that this is going to allow you to advocate differently than you currently have on behalf from some's perspective, this administration's perspective, for an Alaska gas pipeline adjacent to AGDC. And quite frankly, there is concern, and we don't know whether we want to allow that if you can't already do it.
Through the chair, it's not my understanding that this language has anything to do with that. I think this has to do with essentially a funding mechanism for the RCC. I'm not sure that this opens that door.
Mr. Patasson, could you go back and check with the Attorney General? Because here it says the Attorney General shall participate as a party before FERC when the Attorney General determines that participation is in the public interest. And that's what's spurring at least some of the questions at the table, at least from me.
Certainly.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So on that point, you can only intervene at FERC on pipelines that are already in production.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's typically when we would get involved. Yeah.
Right. And what you're looking for is a DGF versus UGF funding mechanism.
Correct.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, thank you. That was what I was pointing out before, but there is, if you look at the title of the bill, the title states to participate as an advocate, and I think that that's where the concern may be raising. Senator Machicki.
And you're correct in the title. Well, we could change it.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, the state has full standing to intervene in any FERC matter that happens within the jurisdiction of the state. That doesn't change in this case. I do see it as a funding mechanism. If FERC regs include state-related processes in almost every case, so I don't believe it changes their ability to advocate or detracts from their ability to advocate on other projects. It's just a funding. But I do still struggle with that last sentence, and I'm not sure I got it answered completely because, I don't know if you want to take another stab at it, but just increasing the pipeline RCC and reducing the RCC paid by utilities in the same sentence, and I think you're right, it is just strangely, but for the record, what you're saying is, in certain cases, you would now bill for work that's specifically FERC under pipelines, where today you don't have that option. It wouldn't reduce the utility RCC, but it may increase the pipeline RCC. Is that in?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that's absolutely correct. I just wanted to, the slide can be a little deceiving there. We have no intention of charging a utility, a water, or a electric consumer for work we're doing on the other side or vice versa. Whether or not it just really has, we're trying to isolate the two, so it shouldn't really reduce the RCC paid by the utilities.
Thank you. Mr. Patasson, we were on slide 11. Did you have other comments on slide 11 for consideration by the committee?
No. Thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer any and all questions the committee may have.
Mr. Patasson, if you could provide us what outside counsel has cost for the last 5 years regarding this issue, that would be helpful.
Okay.
And then if you could tell us what happens to the remainder of, if we don't do this and there's $40,000 lapsing, as the example on slide 7, what happens with that money? Does it go to the general fund? Is it retained in an account? What happens to that money?
Well, essentially,
those receipts.
It's money that isn't collected. So,
It's not collected?
It's not collected. That's correct.
Over a period of time?
Yes. So basically the way the RCC works is that we take a look at last year's billings, for example, and we look at the adjusted revenues of the utilities and the pipelines, and then we basically say, okay, this is what we can charge for the year. This is our max 0.17. And then we actually play out the year, and let's say that we don't hit that 0.17. So that $40,000, for example, just was never collected. So what we're saying is in that year, had we had the ability perhaps to bill for FERC, we would have been able to get the money all the way up to the cap.
Any further questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your question about the outside council, what it's cost us for the last few years. I don't know if you have access to the what our competitors have spent, but if you have, that'd be interesting to know as well.
Oh, certainly.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Machicki.
Just throw something out there, and I for committee members, I can tell you that the largest energy company there's probably 10 or 12 top firms that do FERC work. A lot of them are based in D.C. and they're very, very experienced. And even the largest energy organizations on the planet often use outside counsel because of that expertise. And I think you made the statement that you're certainly not going to try to go head-to-head with that counsel. You're going to continue to use outside counsel, but for a lot of the prep work, you will likely do in-house to reduce cost. Is that right?
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
Any further questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Patterson. I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill 120. An act relating to the Department of Law, public advocacy function to participate in matters that come before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. Is there anyone off-net or online wishing to testify? Anyone here in Juneau? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note for House Bill 120, Department of Law, Appropriations Civil Division, Allocation Regulatory Affairs Public Advocacy, OMB Component Number 2764. Zero analysis. If passed, this bill will have a positive but limited fiscal impact on the Department of Law. While this bill may allow the Department of Law to have some FERC-related costs addressed by RCA receipts, these RCA receipts are limited by AS 4206286A, making general fund appropriations for FERC matters to a continuing necessity. In addition, annual general fund appropriations will continue to be needed to fund the state's defense of FERC matters, which cannot be funded by RCA receipts under existing law, even with this amendment.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Are there questions on the fiscal note? Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't want to spend a lot of time. This is a little bit of an unusual fiscal note because you are giving additional billing authority, which seems like it would be indeterminate since it's different than what generates the DGF today. I don't know if Department of Law wants to comment on that because there is likely a differential from what's being collected today.
The Department of Law really, Mr. Patterson, would you like to speak to that?
Not at this time. I'll like to think about it.
Thank you. Okay, with that, amendments are due by this Wednesday at 5 p.m. on House Bill 120. On tomorrow's agenda, we have SB 105, Marital and Family Therapeutic Licensing and Services, SB 108, Medical Care and Licensed Medical Board, SB 165, Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. Is there anything to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.